Ohio is one of the leading states for data centers with more than 230 of them. How are they benefiting and burdening our region, its residents, and the environment? And how do we chart the best path forward? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now are Data Center Coalition Vice President of State Policy, Dan DiOrio, Williamsburg resident and Conserve Ohio organizer, Jessica Baker, Ohio State Senator Bill Blessing, who's a Colerain Township Republican, Save Ohio Parks Board Member Rachel Cutsley, and Logistics President Doug Swain. Thank you all for being here today. We appreciate it. Dan, I want to start with you. Everybody by now is aware of the pushback in some communities toward data centers. There are lots of politicians and businesses who are invested in bringing them here. To kick things off in just a few sentences, what should we know about data centers in our communities?
I think it's important to level set first and foremost, which is that there's a misperception that everything associated with data centers is all AI all the time. And the reality is very much that data centers are being built today for cloud infrastructure. The vast majority of data centers being built today are for cloud. Cloud is the underpinning of everything that we do every day. It's how we work, it's how we learn, it's how we communicate. Every online purchase, every online classroom, every electronic healthcare record, every connected device, and the average household has 21 connected devices when you start to add them all up. And so data centers are being built to service our everyday lives and for the 21st century economy. AI is an important growth driver, there's no question. But really, it's important to remember that the data centers being put into operation today support all of those devices and services that we rely on. The last thing that I would say as well is that data centers are an economic driver for Ohio. What we see is data centers creating over 100,000 jobs in 2024, generating over $14 billion to Ohio's GDP, and generating over $1 billion in state and local government revenue in the state. And Ohio is poised, I think, to really become the technology hub of the Midwest. Data centers are a key part of that and are a key part of the Ohio economy.
Jessica, you're a Williamsburg, Ohio resident in Claremont County. I know you talk to a lot of your neighbors. Dan just kind of made the case for data centers. What are you hearing from neighbors about how they feel about data centers?
Well, the ones coming to all of Ohio now are hyperscale, so they're nothing like the ones that we currently have that has ran our cloud and let me play on Facebook for the last 20 years. So they're concerned about exactly what they are and the environmental impacts, the farmland, the water, the power coming in and possibilities of, you know, losing homes for that. And they're concerned about everything. There's not one thing, the tax abatements, everything.
Well, let's talk about job creation. Dan just made some comments about that. Rachel, lots of state leaders have claimed that data centers are job creators. I know you've really looked into this. What has your research found?
I think a lot of the jobs associated with data centers are in the construction phase. They don't tend to need a lot of employment, a lot of jobs once they're into the operational phase. The piece of data centers that we're especially concerned with is that most of them at this time are being powered with gas generation, with new gas plants. And that's locking us into this fossil fuel system for decades into the future. And that's really concerning to a lot of Ohioans.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Dan?
What I would say is that there are those that think construction jobs are temporary jobs, and I'd encourage you to talk to anybody in the building trades and say that their job is temporary. There are folks that make careers of what someone considers a temporary job. But when data centers are up and operational, just like when they're being built, we depend on electricians, on plumbers, on HVAC technicians to maintain these facilities. Those are local contractors, local businesses. We're helping to expand manufacturing in the state as well, creating jobs for cooling systems, mechanical components, steel fabrication. So data centers are creating these significant business ecosystems. For every one job in a data center, 4.5 jobs are supported elsewhere in the economy.
I know a study by Brookings found data centers do create jobs, but it depends on the type of data centers. Their study found that hyperscale projects actually create more jobs than co-location data centers and clusters
generate the biggest effect. Doug, is that anything that you've looked into as a developer of these sites?
Yes, we've done a number of economic impact studies. Have looked at jobs, looked at the investment, looked at, you know, tax revenue and different aspects of the data centers. On the jobs component, I think it's easy to look at those and easy to look at the pictures and think about what a data center is and say, boy, there's no jobs. It's just a warehouse full of computers. But as Dan alluded to, you know, there are jobs associated with the maintenance and the technical and the engineering aspects of those facilities. They're very sophisticated. And we've done impact studies that have looked at those jobs that are typically created are 50% over the state average in terms of wages. So they're providing good jobs. They're providing jobs that are in a technical field, in an IT field, which is a field that's going to continue to grow and it's not going anywhere. There are spin-off construction jobs that are created. And those construction jobs, if you're talking about an AI campus, that some of these are multiple buildings that build, you know, one or two buildings at a time, you know, those jobs could stretch out 5, 7, 8 years or beyond just the construction. And then also, as was alluded to, there is a lot of, we've seen a lot of spin-off benefit. I mean, there are, you know, as those buildings are being built, you know, there are firms that will then locate close to them that will provide the racking, the CPUs, the electrical components, the electrical service needs, the IT service needs. So there's a whole host of different, you know, aspects to the jobs there, and the jobs that are directly related to them are, as I mentioned, they're good wage paying jobs that are good for communities. And I might also add that in some cases we've heard, you know, people look to those jobs and say, well, these people aren't going to be located close to the facility. Maybe they're remote or maybe they're otherwise. But the reality is a lot of those jobs need to really be, to be efficient, they need to be located close to those facilities. If an IT engineer that's responsible for the operations of a, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of equipment, and that equipment goes out at 2 a.m. in the morning, they're probably going to need to go on site to determine what needs to be done or what needs to be serviced there. They don't want to be living, you know, miles away or even 20 minutes away, ideally. So in that sense, we've seen some of the communities, you look at that, and it also supports housing and different things in the community that, again, will benefit community. And that also benefits the community in other ways as it relates to tax bases, which are a big, you know, concern and a big focal point for a lot of communities as well.
Yeah, we're going to dig into that. We're talking today about data centers and communities. We'll be taking questions from the people in our studio audience. If you've got a question, raise your hand and one of my colleagues will meet you with a microphone. So don't be shy. We want to hear your questions. I do want to talk about the impact on property taxes. Senator Blessing, could these data center development deals, depending on how local governments structure them, help lower property taxes for homeowners? What kind of impact do you think they could have?
Sure. I think they could, to the extent that they work out things like pilots, which is payment in lieu of taxes with the local governments and schools, in order to bring in more revenue for them. But you see, the thing is, these are, you know, sort of one-offs. It's almost like thinking of school districts, you know, 5, 10, 20 years ago that happened to have a power plant in their backyard. And when that power plant goes away, then they're, you know, in a bad position with respect to revenue. I think the big issue with this is that, you know, when we talk about property tax relief in Ohio, you know, that's great that a data center can, you know, potentially offer some significant amount of revenue to a local government, but it glosses over the much larger and frankly unaddressed issue of property taxes at the state level. And what I'm getting at with that is that we are not doing what we should be doing with respect to school funding, which, again, schools are the largest consumers of property tax revenue. I've said repeatedly that, you know, and I have it from LSC with the research, we're 37th in the country in terms of state level per pupil property public education dollars being spent. And we're the worst of our surrounding states. So much so, if we did the entirety of the fair school funding formula with the full inputs, we'd still be the worst of our surrounding states. That's how bad it is. My point with all this is to say that, you know, that's great that data centers can help with that property tax side of things. But frankly, the ire should be turned towards the General Assembly, where we were just peachy to give $600 million for a Browns stadium. We were just peachy to do a top rate tax cut to get to a flat 275. That was $1.6 billion. And, you know, as much as I understand the data center folks, you know, get quite a bit of money from that sales and use tax exemption that they enjoy, some of whom get it for 40 years, the price tag for that came in at $1.5 billion. And if a lot of that money had been funneled to school funding, things like property tax circuit breakers, we wouldn't be really having as much of a discussion on property tax relief. And I think Ohioans are well within their right to look at the General Assembly and ask, what about us? You seem to be more interested in businesses than the people at large.
Looks like we have a question in the audience. Can you tell me your name and your question?
My name is Sasina Erko, and my question is to really Doug and Dan. I know, Dan, you mentioned there were, you know, roughly around 100,000 jobs created when data centers are being built, and there's a, you know, a couple of years down the line, there are jobs. I think there needs to be a nuanced conversation in this particular case because, yeah, at the beginning of data centers being built, it may take 100,000, maybe to, you know, a couple of thousand people to build it. But what are we talking about when we're saying jobs created? I mean, if it only takes 10 people to manage a data center, then is that really, yeah, the margin of revenue is really large for those people, but what kind of impact is that creating to the community? So I think there needs to be a really nuanced conversation, an honest conversation to be exact.
And if I could go ahead and respond to that. So Vertiv is a homegrown Ohio company, and they just announced an expansion with an additional over 500 jobs. Vertiv is building cooling systems for data centers. That's the tangible impact that we see from the industry. We depend on a robust domestic manufacturing industry to help service the industry. With that comes that business ecosystem impact. Larger scale campuses now have likely over 100 employees that are on site to those. And again, it's that contracting as well. We need those local electricians. We need the local plumbers. We need the local HVAC techs to be working on these facilities and be available to work on those facilities 24/7, 365. These are jobs that don't require a traditional four-year degree. You can go through, obviously, you can work with the local labor unions and organizations there to get training on up-to-date equipment, to get a really good paying job, not just for data centers, but for a variety of industries, but also inside the data centers themselves. You can go through a couple months certification program and then come out as a data center technician making high five figures into low six figures right out of that. These are transformational job opportunities. But it also should be said too, data centers aren't going to have that kind of local impact that other large facilities do. You know, there are communities that don't have the housing to support a 3,000 person manufacturing plant. There are communities that don't have the schools to support those kids. And what they actually get from data centers is a significant amount of revenue. And so it fits their needs very well. For some communities, they may need that manufacturing plant that has 3,000 permanent jobs with it. It may fit their needs very well. But for others, a data center might be a better fit. So I think it comes down to what is the economic development needs there.
I want to come back to Senator Blessing because you mentioned the sales tax exemption that Ohio has. I know Governor DeWine put a pause on that. What about property tax exemptions? Do data centers sometimes receive property tax exemptions in the deals they make with local communities?
Yeah, I think some of them do. Although I will admit I don't have the numbers on that. I think when you look at what the state has done with respect to CRAs and TIFs and whatnot over the years, what we've authorized local governments to do, that probably eclipses that effect. But, you know, as I've said repeatedly, property tax exemptions, generally speaking, kind of, you know, basically shrink the pie and expect more from the pie to fund our public goods, whether it's local governments or schools for that matter. But again, that's, you know, a local decision. You know, if the local government is going to give somebody a 100% property tax break, as much as I think that would be a silly idea, you know, that's kind of the idea of federalism, that a local government can do that. The sales and use tax thing is a little different, I think, in the sense that, you know, when the Senate was considering doing House Bill 646, where he did a number of reforms in that bill, we had it in a place where both parties were going to vote for this, and it was going to cut that in half. And I think the recognition, and that wasn't the only thing that was in the bill. There was some work requiring closed loop systems. There was some work requiring more reporting and transparency with this. There was also some work with respect to requiring more behind-the-meter generation for the data centers. But I think most of us in Columbus, when we were dealing with that about a month ago today, was that those were overly generous and we could have very easily not done as much and the data centers still would have come here.
We have another question in the audience.
Hi, my name is Ray Crawford. I'm an enterprise architect at Unisys, and my question is kind of targeted at you, Senator Blessing. Are we, with all this angst towards data center development, in a climate where we have to buy data centers? And then on top of that, how do we legislate pulling more of the manufacturing, like Vertiv, for example, into the state?
So, you know, I think with respect to data centers here, and I don't want to make it sound like I'm anti-data center. I just think that there's a difference between giving away the farm on a lot of this. And to give you an idea with what we're talking about with like that 40-year 100% sales and use tax exemption that's been, you know, the subject of such criticism, you know, the state of Ohio, we cannot appropriate things for more than 2 years. So if we say so-and-so is going to get $1 million break, it only lasts for the General Assembly, we'd have to reappropriate that again the next cycle. But to have somebody behind the scenes years before say, here's a 40-year exemption, sorry about your luck, that's a problem from a public policy and just good government aspect. But in terms of like bringing more jobs in here in manufacturing, I always go back to you want to have strong public goods. I think the attitude seems to be in Columbus that, hey, you know, we just give businesses money and they're going to come here. And it's like, well, they need employees. People want to have a reason to live here. Maybe we should be doing more on that side instead of giving subsidies out to businesses. But I think for striking a balance on something like this, and I think, you know, when we talk about labor and all this, I am very glad that the construction trades are doing very well. I've heard from Matt Selassie, who heads up ACT Ohio. It's been absolutely tremendous for them. Great. I hope that continues. The issue also is, though, from a public standpoint, you have all of those construction trades being pushed towards the data centers. It requires a lot of labor. There's an opportunity cost there. That's going to drive up labor for everything else, including the housing that we desperately need, including the grid and generation infrastructure that we needed more of even prior to the data center boom. You know, things like water, sewer, you name it, roads and bridges. And so I think fundamentally, most people understand data centers are here. We can live with them, but we don't want to be sneered at by an oligarchy that's like, well, we can put them here and there and there's going to be no transparency and you're just going to have to like it, which is one of the reasons why I've been working on a proposal that simply said, all right, you're a data center here in Ohio. You're going to have to be licensed to be in Ohio. And in order to get that license, you have to pay a base fee and there will be a tiered fee on top of that. And that tiered fee is tied to the amount of energy you use less behind the meter. And that will be put into a fund to, ideally, I'd wanted to do a Connecticut-style public green bank to put that into renewable energy projects so that you would actually have a lot more energy infrastructure that we need in addition to the oil and gas. And the thing is with that is also that it's, you know, I could see some of the labor folks were like, well, you know, we don't want you to touch data centers. And I understand that. But guys, you win twice in the sense that you're going to be the same people that are working on data centers would be the same people working on these renewable infrastructure projects. But instead of being a, you know, data center centric thing, it would be for the entire public. And I think that's probably where a lot of Ohioans want to be, can live with data centers, but they want to see that they're paying their fair share. They want to see that the, you know, tech bros are paying their fair share. They do want to see that labor is doing well, but they also rightfully have the question, if there's a market crash and the AI boom falls apart, then what? Now you've got a lot of labor folks that have been ramping up the number of members that they have, and now there's not the work. How do we transition them? And I would hope the General Assembly in a case like that would look at sort of New Deal politics there and start building out more public infrastructure, whether that's, again, roads and bridges or even housing, which a lot of other countries do.
We've got a lot more to talk about. We'll talk more about this behind the meter notion after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our conversation about data centers and communities. My guests are Data Center Coalition Vice President of State Policy, Dan DiOrio, Williamsburg resident and Conserve Ohio organizer, Jessica Baker, Ohio State Senator Bill Blessing, Save Ohio Parks Board Member Rachel Cutsley, and Logistics President Doug Swain. We're taking questions from people in our studio audience. If you have a question, raise your hand and one of my colleagues will meet you with a microphone. It looks like we have one right out of the gate.
Hi, this question is for Dan DiOrio. Why are we positioning these data centers in places throughout Ohio that are destroying beautiful farmland that's highly productive when we could put these places around the urban centers, Cincinnati, Columbus, Cleveland, Dayton, for example, where you don't have to move people, that there's plenty of them. There are vacant lots and tons of areas of that need to be revitalized and can house these facilities. So why is the choice to ruin farmland and a business that we need in this state to place this, replace it with this other business that's sort of out of place because of its distance away from the resources it needs to function?
Well, I think it's important first and foremost to talk to the farmer. It's their private property, it's their land. Ultimately, you know, they can make the decision if they'd like to sell or not. I know anecdotally from farmers that I've heard in various states, they have said oftentimes, this is a portion of the land that I can't realistically farm anymore, that I can't realistically do anything with. It's just not traditionally productive. Now, it's not the case everywhere. I understand that, but just giving an important anecdote. What I would say is it's a fair question to talk about where we site data centers. And I think it's important to have that conversation about, you know, maybe they shouldn't be located across the street from a residential neighborhood. And I think that's an important conversation that we have to have. I think as an industry, we're trying to be more reactive to that and be more proactive to say, where are the brownfield sites? Where's the pre-industrial zone sites where we can go in and has access to infrastructure and has, you know, is readily kind of built out for these types of developments? But, you know, I think ultimately this comes down to, you know, traditionally data centers have been in urban centers. That's where you see them. If you go to downtown Cincinnati, you'll see Cyrus One there. They started at Cincinnati Bell. They've been providing co-location services to Cincinnati for years. And most folks probably didn't realize it was already there. But now as data centers have expanded out, you know, we know how to build these things efficiently. And as you aggregate the needs together, you leverage economies of scale to achieve efficiencies. And that's what data centers are. They are a far more efficient way of doing all the computing, processing, and storage that we need. So we've, you know, I think by necessity seen data centers move out to other areas where there is more land available, there is access to infrastructure, and there may be an opportunity, I think, you know, to help revitalize rural communities. But the question of siting of data centers is absolutely a fair one. I think it's a conversation we need to have. But again, just always remember, this is private property, and I think it's important to talk to those folks as to why they sold.
Doug, I know you wanted to weigh in very quickly.
Yeah, I was just going to say these really aren't randomly chosen locations. In the case of the hyperscalers, most of those hyperscalers really require as part of their business plan 300, 600, 800 plus acres. And it needs to be located close to the infrastructure that can support the facility. So that is why that tends to lead the developers out into rural communities, into farmland. And similar to also what Dan alluded to, the ones that are closer to the city in the urban core, there still are those. There are still demand for those. There are still people that are looking at, building at, siting facilities that are close to urban centers. In fact, they're in demand and continuing to be more and more demand, but it's a little different use. And it's a little different. You're not going to find 300 acres just outside the urban core of Cincinnati or Atlanta or any other tier one or tier two city. For those larger infrastructure projects, you really need more land.
I want to get to energy use real quickly. I know we've got questions in the audience, but Rachel, how do data centers get the power they use typically? And can you explain the behind the meter energy generators that Senator Blessing referred to?
Yeah, this is a crucial piece of the conversation. Up until now, most data centers have been pulling from the grid directly. So they're using the same electricity that we all use, and that's increasing energy prices for everybody, for all of our consumers. At this point, the hyperscalers need so much energy. A hyperscale data center is one that uses at least 100 megawatts of electricity. So they need lots of electricity, and the grid really can't meet their needs at this point. And so they've moved to a behind-the-meter model, as the senator mentioned. And so that means they're building their own generation on site, on their own property that they control. And because of the size limitations to that, they're building natural gas. They're building traditional gas power plants. They're siting them a lot of times in residential neighborhoods and cities. And so they're building all of this gas infrastructure without any public consultation, without any public comment. The way that we got here is over the last 10 to 15 years, the Ohio legislature and our Ohio energy policy has made it more and more difficult to build renewables, while at the same time making it easier, quicker, and less transparent to build gas generation and gas infrastructure. And so we've ended up in this situation where data centers are building their own gas infrastructure, and they don't have the ability to build renewables. And that's really something that we would like to see change.
So, Rachel, how much energy do these data centers use?
So the hyperscaler data centers, the ones that we're talking about, start at 100 megawatts, but they can be huge. So some of them, one going into Asheville, Ohio, that's a small village of 5,000 people, it's going to use 800 megawatts. They're building a gas plant right next to this village of 5,000 people. It's going to be next to their schools, next to their soccer fields. They're getting a major traditional gas power plant right there in their community. In New Albany, outside of Columbus, Meta is building another 800 megawatt facility that's going to have two gas power plants totaling 400 megawatts. And then there's one planned for Pike County in the south of the state that they are planning to build 9 gigawatts of gas generation. That's supposed to be the largest gas generation plant in the world. And again, this is all locking us into decades of needing to get gas to power those generation facilities. And most of that gas in Ohio is coming from fracking. So that is also destroying our environment. It has lots of negative health impacts. And these are all things that we should be thinking through in terms of how do we want to build out our future economy in Ohio.
Let's go to a question in the audience.
My name's Beth Sullivarger, and I'm glad that the environmental impacts are being discussed today, particularly energy and farmland. I don't see why we can't use alternative energy for these plants, geothermal, solar. They have huge roof expanses that could be used for solar. Also, in terms of water, can't these facilities recycle water? Thank you.
I'd like to, go ahead and answer that. No. 24% of counties in the country have an impediment to building wind and solar, according to USA Today. There's a really good broader conversation to have about ultimately how we permit these things and how you can use different energy sources. This is an industry that is heavily investing in renewable energy, responsible for half of all corporate clean energy procurement in 2024, 84% of all corporate clean energy procurement from January through July of last year, according to S&P Global. This industry is putting its private capital out there to advance the clean energy transition. It's investing in geothermal technologies as well. It's investing in advanced nuclear, investing in battery storage, and in traditional wind and solar. So this is an industry that will continue to invest in that. And when it comes to water use, yes, data centers are using recycled water. A lot of that comes to what is the local supply available for that. A robust local supply will obviously help. And that enables data centers to operate on that. For example, in Santa Clara, California, heart of Silicon Valley, 65% of data centers there are on their recycled water system. So having that robust infrastructure, you will absolutely see data centers take advantage of that. We're trying to figure out ways to use brackish water or produce water in places like West Texas. So there's a lot of technological innovation happening to really advance those different sources of water that may be available.
If I can jump in on that a little bit, another significant piece of the water use associated with data centers is with cooling the energy generation facilities. So when you have a thermal gas plant that's powering your data center, that requires a lot of water to cool that gas plant. There's also millions of gallons of water associated with the fracking to get the gas to power that gas plant. When you frack for gas, you do it by shooting all of this water under high pressure underground to bring up the oil, or to bring up the gas rather. And then all of that water comes back as contaminated with toxic elements, with radioactive elements, and it has to be permanently removed from the water supply. So those are other two major water uses associated with data centers, specifically because of the fuel type that they're using to power them.
Jessica, what are you hearing from your neighbors about all of that, about energy uses, water? I mean, what are you hearing from folks?
Well, in Adams County, they're going to use the river water, and the data center is going in a holler, 1,000 acres, and it'll be 1,300 megawatts with over 500 diesel generators. So the generational farmers that live next to that private land don't get a say-so in what's going to happen to where they live, where they fish and have recreation on the water and, you know, farm their land that they can't sit on their porch because the diesel generators are going to go. And so the concerns are huge. With nuclear power in Ripley, nobody wanted to talk about. It's just everywhere.
We have another question from the audience.
Yeah, I'm glad Jessica just mentioned the diesel generators, because I'm concerned about the noise and pollution from diesel backup generators. Most data centers need to have a backup source of energy on site, and many of them today are relying on hundreds and hundreds of backup generators if it's a hyperscale data center. And most people think they only run when there's a power outage, but actually, in order to make sure that they're ready to go 24/7, there's an industry standard that says every one of them needs to be exercised at least once a week. And so diesels run dirtiest when they're in startup mode and they're starting up and shutting down all the time in order to make sure they're ready for a power outage. So can you talk a little bit about the backup generators and the impacts of those?
Yeah, I'll start there. So data centers are essential services. As you mentioned, they have backup power. And that's because if something were to, you know, happen, power would be interrupted to the facility. We need to have access to medical records, to online classrooms, to 911 geolocation, all the services that are really essential when, you know, if the power goes out, traditionally something's pretty wrong. Those generators are heavily permitted. They're heavily permitted from EPA down through the state. As you mentioned, they can only run in those certain situations, which does include testing and maintenance. I'll give you a stat out of Virginia, which is the largest market in the world. Data centers in Virginia only ran 7% of their allotted time in 2024. So, you know, I think it's important that with a reliable, resilient grid, data centers are not running those backups. They are truly for backup and they do the testing. And I think it's important to also make sure that we have the right type of mechanisms in place. You'll see data centers work with those communities to do public notices, things like when they're doing the testing, so that residents know exactly what, you know, what's going on at that facility all time. So it's just important contextual information. It's the only scalable, reliable source for backup generation out there. Folks have talked about battery storage and everything like that. We'd need football fields worth of batteries. And then I can tell you, you know, we'll get questions of fire risk and things like that. And so it ultimately becomes what's the most scalable, reliable, and safe workplace technology that we know of. And that's diesel backup for now.
Jessica, you want to weigh in?
So 504 diesel generators at Amazon Science Fair they had, they said 504 generators would run 6 minutes every 2 weeks, each one, which comes out to almost 2 months continuous if you ran them 2 months. And then in June, when we had the heat wave at the beginning of July, PJM had to put 15 pages worth of places on backup. So the concern of people living next to those is, I mean, it's already the testing period that they're going to run, but PJM can't handle what we have. What's going to happen when that's pulling 1,300 megawatts?
So again, PJM called on them to take power off the grid. And so for data centers, we can't go down. We're the internet. It's 24/7, 365. And I think the first time that a data center goes down without being able to utilize its backup for that short period of time, I think it'll probably be the last time that that ever happens, because folks will see their services interrupted and they will say, what is going on? And so, again, these are heavily permitted. These things cannot run willy-nilly. They have to run under permitted conditions. And those are permits by the EPA and by the state.
Got a question in the audience?
Thank you. This is Andrew Bateman from Loveland, Ohio. I have a question a little bit about land use. And we've talked a little bit about how these data centers would come in and the land use would be necessary to be changed. So my question is really to anyone on the panel that can help allay some of the fears that residents have that the decision to put a data center in their community is not being done on a local level. I think it's one of those things that we want to understand that we have local control over this issue. And whether it's a want or a need or the reciprocation of different incentives, I think our communities deserve to make the determination for themselves whether they want a data center.
Rachel, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think that's a great point and a great concern. The actual data center permits are handled at the local level, but what we've seen is that a lot of developers come in and they have non-disclosure agreements with the local government. And I think that's what a lot of people really object to, is not having a way to know what's happening in their community, in their area. And I think that really points to the need for more public consultation. The piece that local authorities don't have any say over is the gas generation. So once you've approved a data center, they can go ahead and build that full-size gas power plant right in the middle of your community with no local input, with no local notice or hearings, because the gas infrastructure is only permitted at the state level. And that's really contrasts with how Ohio treats wind and solar that do have a local input requirement, a requirement for local hearings. And so what we'd like to see is equal treatment of wind, solar, gas. All of our generation should be permitted equally on a fair playing field.
I know we've got a lot more questions. We'll be back to continue our conversation about data centers after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our discussion about data centers and communities. My guests are Data Center Coalition Vice President of State Policy, Dan DiOrio, Williamsburg resident and Conserve Ohio organizer, Jessica Baker, State Senator Bill Blessing, Save Ohio Parks Board Member, Rachel Cutsley, and Logistics President, Doug Swain. If you're here in our studio audience and you have a question, please raise your hand and one of our colleagues can meet you with a microphone. I want to talk about transparency. This issue of NDAs came up earlier. Jessica, what has it personally taken for you and your neighbors to get information about data center developments?
As of yesterday, I had a records request out in Mount Orb from March 25th, so well over 100 days. The zoning was, they did the right thing yesterday, so I'm not worried about the records request anymore. But we have to wait weeks, sometimes longer. And what we get sometimes is heavily redacted to get the information. Without records requests, we wouldn't know that it is the end user is a data center in Mount Orb. And that facility is 1,200 acres and next to subdivisions. But there are that's a village of 4,000 people, and there are over 50 NDAs for just that one village.
So how do you get information out to the public?
Oh, I just run my mouth.
Doug, why do so many of these projects have NDAs, use non-disclosure agreements?
Well, so it's not that much different than a lot of projects that come into a town that are economic development projects. I mean, for a long, long time, and it continues to be the case that for a variety of reasons, you have companies have NDAs when they come in, they give them a project name. And there's a variety of reasons for that. I mean, there's reasons, competitive reasons. There's reasons that might impact the employees that currently work for those companies. In some of these cases, there's proprietary systems and so forth that are involved. So I think initially what you have is, and a lot of these have to do with the larger companies. Initially, they come in And when they're doing their initial validation or feasibility of a particular site, they will issue an NDA. That is the easiest, best way and most efficient way to refer to that company between economic development officials. A lot of times, at a minimum, the economic development or the leaders of the community will know who that company is. And eventually that company, as it continues to move through the process, will let themselves be known to the community as well. In fact, most of these groups hold community meetings, community, you know, information sessions and so forth, so the community can come in and ask them direct questions about what they're going to be doing in the community, you know, how they're going to be utilizing water and energy and all of those things. So I think a lot of it is there's a focus on it, but it's not that much different than we've seen in economic development for a long, long time. And there's reasons for it. And it has to do with kind of on that front end of site feasibility and evaluation of the sites more than anything, really.
So, Dan, do you feel like the information gets out to the public when it needs to get out to the public? Because it sounds like a lot of communities want information a whole lot earlier than they're getting it.
Yeah, I think it's when a project decides to move forward and says, yes, we are planning to build on this site. That's when they, you know, make themselves known, because there's public disclosure that comes with that. I do think it's we should ask the question, are we going to apply the same rules to every type of economic development project? Again, I can tell you anecdotally, Central Virginia, there was a big uproar about an NDA, and they said, this is a data center. This is a data center. It was a distribution center for a large home improvement company. So these are, you know, used widely throughout economic development. And I think we need to have discussions about how we apply, you know, the same rules for all. And I think this is not exclusively a data center question, but it's oftentimes framed in those terms.
But for data centers, people are very interested in that. How do you communicate with the public? Like when you feel like it's time, what's the way to get that word out?
Well, I think it is incumbent upon the industry to have robust stakeholder engagement processes in place. And I think it's fair to say that the industry has not done a good job of that. That's absolutely fair. I think you're seeing the industry heavily invest in that now, doing community engagement earlier, doing stakeholder engagement, trying to explain what these projects are, what they aren't, how they are going to use resources wisely, and how they are going to be of economic benefit to the community. And so it really, you know, is when a data center decides to move forward, is going to develop, that's when you see the information released. And the industry is really, I think, making progress in that direction. But of course, as I said, I think it's a fair question to say that we need to get better at it.
Rachel, did you want to weigh in?
I think the community engagement piece is really important, and I absolutely think that's something the developer should be doing. But it really shouldn't be incumbent on a community of 5,000 people to try to negotiate with, you know, a huge company, a billion-dollar company that's coming in to develop these things. And a 5,000-person community doesn't have the expertise in water reuse and battery power and all of these things that they would need to know to get a good deal, or to, you know, to make sure that they are protecting their land, protecting the health of those communities. And so I think the piece that's missing here is regulation at the state level to make sure that these data centers are behaving responsibly and are really benefiting Ohioans. So regulations in terms of water use, regulations in terms of energy use, regulations in terms of where they're getting that energy. So you're seeing this in other states. They're requiring data centers to build their own new clean energy. Beyonce, it's a really catchy acronym. But you can do this differently, and the state needs to take some action to put in place some regulations here.
Senator Blessing.
Yes. So that's this is very timely, considering I was talking about this similar topic just this morning about housing. With respect to energy, I think most people do not want to live next to a gas power plant or something like that. Totally understand that. That's one of the reasons why Ohio has something called the Ohio Power Siting Board that sort of trumps some of this, where we recognize as a state that we need energy generation. And I agree with Rachel, it should be all of the above, not just coal or gas. It should be renewable as well. But if a community doesn't, if this is a perfect place to build it and a community doesn't want to build it there, that NIMBYism actually can really harm the state. It's definitely harming the state with housing. It could harm the state more if the Power Siting Board wasn't there. Frankly, we probably need something like a data center siting board from Ohio, and that would also have public input for these things. But instead of the imbalance and leverage that Rachel brought up, very valid point, instead of it being a small community of 5,000 people, it's now the entire state of Ohio. And that puts things on a more equal footing. But beyond that, you know, whether it's, you know, the State Power Siting Board, then things like House Bill 646, excuse me, come into play, which was the data center reform bill before it didn't pass a month ago, that would say, all right, if you want to come to Ohio, you're coming to us, data center siting board. What are you going to bring to the table? Are you going to do closed loop? Are you going to do this? Are you going to do that? And they could just as easily deny that if this was, you know, sort of a fly-by-night operation, which those do exist. I've heard some of the data center folks talk about that before. But this way, you would have more transparency, more oversight, more leverage. But in exchange for that, the data centers then, if they bring all of this to the table correctly, the NIMBYism wouldn't be there, because then that could be over, the local level stuff could be overridden the same way as the Power Siting Board overrides energy concerns. Now, I know that that can be somewhat controversial with respect to local control, but it's even more controversial to say, I don't want any energy center anywhere in my community, and then the state has a real issue with energy generation. There has to be some balance with it. So my vote is certainly for a data center siting board in Ohio.
We are running out of time in a hurry. Rachel, you've got some proposals related to powering data centers. You've mentioned them a little bit, but tell us briefly about those.
Yeah, we'd like to see data centers getting their power from renewable energy, wind, solar, battery storage, and they can do that different ways. They can do it on site with their behind the meter. If Ohio had virtual net metering, so this would require a legislative change, they could build off-site large-scale solar farms, battery storage to power their data centers, or a really innovative model that they're actually piloting down in Texas is for data centers to support residential rooftop solar and battery storage in the houses around them. And I just think that's so exciting because it directly reduces consumers' electricity bills. It gives that data center a guaranteed power source, and it means cleaner air for everybody. So I just think there's some really exciting options, alternatives out there, and we shouldn't be fooled into thinking that we have to do it with gas. There are other ways that we can make sure this benefits Ohioans.
Dan, in just about a minute and a half that we have left, in Rachel's study on data centers, she wrote that we can capitalize on the economic opportunities they bring while ensuring that their growth benefits local communities. What's the best way to do that? How can we do that?
Well, I think first and foremost is certainty and predictability. I think we see a lot of questions and different proposals out there. And we see, I think, you know, different kind of scattershot actions at the local level. I think certainty and predictability is key to bringing long-term steel in the ground investment into the state. I think what's also key as well is recognizing data and facts and context for around some of these key issues. You know, first and foremost, you know, the sales tax exemption in Ohio, it's based on manufacturing sales tax exemptions, which have a far larger price tag than the data center sales tax exemption does. It allows you to get more energy efficient servers into the facility on a regular basis. It generates all the additional economic activity that we see. We see 11% return on investment in a state like Virginia, again, largest market in the world. Data centers are utilizing so many different hybrid techniques. Closed loop is not the be all end all for water. Data centers utilize outside ambient air to cool during the coldest months. We need to have those options available. And I think, you know, first and foremost, we need to have an environment that's based in, you know, fact-based data, data-driven conversations. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to have that and to focus on how do we keep Ohioans employed? How do we invest in new workforce opportunities? But again, how do we do it right? And how do we do it responsibly? I think those are important questions. We look forward to being a part of that.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Dan DiOrio of the Data Center Coalition, Williamsburg resident Jessica Baker, State Senator Bill Blessing, Rachel Cutsley with Save Ohio Parks, and Logistics President Doug Swain. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical directors are Carlos Lopez-Cornu and Will Staffen. A big thanks to everybody here at Cincinnati Public Radio who helped with this show. Too many people to thank by name, but you know who you are. I'm Lucy May. You can watch our live YouTube stream for more of this conversation, because we're going to keep going for a little while. Thank you all so much for being here.